Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Jacksonville coach John Galloway as we continue to talk about recruiting as the month of September winds on. Coach Galloway, we are recording this on the eve of September 1st. It will run afterward. We really appreciate your time and joining us on the podcast and look forward to a conversation.
I appreciate it. I've been envious listening to some of the podcasts leading up to 9-1 and excited to be on it. And, you know, my mind's already been racing, listening. So looking forward to having a chance to catch up with you on it.
Well, since you've listened to them, you know that we've kind of had two formats in terms of how we've structured these conversations. The first was talking about how you evaluate and then talking about how you communicate. And then we kind of shifted gears and talked a little bit more linearly. In the more recent podcasts that have been recorded but haven't been posted yet, so you wouldn't have been as privy to the format, we kind of bounced around from topic to topic. And I see this conversation being a little bit of a melding of all three. I think that there are a couple of things about your approach and about Jacksonville in general that lend itself to that topic format. But I don't want to lose the forest for the trees. And you are so good at giving specific answers to general questions. So let me just start the way we started a month ago. How do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
Yeah, I do rely so much on being emotionally evoked. And I think that the only way for us to, you know, throw the net that we do that's so national and international is to feel some sort of change in your emotion when you're on the field. And, you know, Ronnie Caputo told me years ago, if you can't remember a kid's name off the top of your head, then he didn't move you to a point where you'll be excited that he's in your class. And I've kind of used that litmus test for me and our staff. You know, when we're talking about names, you know, when you start to talk about it and when you slam on the table for a kid, you know that that's done something to one of our staff members. So by using that as kind of a gauge, I think we've been able to tighten up our process. But at the same time, we also know, you know, we have to have a larger net in our program. So trying to be open-minded to that, but also know that if we're going to contact a guy on September 1st as a junior, we better be excited about that because we're going to have to live with that. That's a 6-year decision for us. And that's got to be one that, you know, moves us.
One of the things that I'm always so fascinated by, and you're not the first goalie that we've had on this conversation, but I want to ask about how you evaluate in the context of having been a goalie. Number one, because you're famously a goalie. Number two, because I also was a goalie. And I think about it in the context of why I think goalies make good head coaches. And it's because of the need to have a universal perspective on the game. You can't get pigeonholed into how you played and what it means, because if you recruit a team full of goalies, you're not going to score very many goals. But also, as a goalie, you had a perspective on Dodgers, you had a perspective on shooters, you had a perspective on defensemen. So, point being that, like, you have a point of view on pretty much the entire field. How do you think being a goalie specifically has informed what you value in terms of athleticism versus production, what you value? And let's go position by position and start with attack. What do you value about attackmen that you think is informed more than your peers by virtue of your experience as a goaltender?
It's an awesome question. I do use it when coaching our goalies as like, you're the only person that gets to go to the movies and watch the entire movie. You know, the attackmen have an angled view. The defensemen can only see the first half and the goalies get to watch the entire cinema. And I use that when recruiting in terms of what scared me in the net. And when I think about the best players I played against, I think about poise, command, structure. You know, the best players that I played against, it always made you feel like something was about to happen, were the guys that maybe moved a little bit slower. You know, I think about the Rob Pinnells, the Steel Stanwicks, the Ben Rubiers. They moved at a pace that wasn't lightning fast because they had to control the game. There was a structure to how they were operating, but you knew that at any moment, something could happen. Sometimes I find that the guys that are quick, explosive, fast dodgers, change of direction, change of speed, all the things that we want in our players, that doesn't mean that they can operate in the offense. And if you're going to be a 60-minute attackman, especially at this level, you have to have this knowledge of the pace of the game, understanding the shot clock, understanding how you control the defense and dictate what happens next. So I find that the guys, you know, I can certainly point to guys on our team that are great examples, but, you know, I think of the Rob Pinnells that play kind of even keel and be able to play with their head up, that become the most dangerous players at this level.
So John Galloway wouldn't have taken Jordan Wolfe. Got it.
I'm gonna lose a friend. He'll let me know if he ever listens to this. I doubt he will. He's bad at podcasts.
I doubt he will as well. midfielders. You know, one of the things that I'm interested in your perspective on before we really dive into how you evaluate midfielders is how you identify midfielder roles, particularly in a post-shot clock era. I spent most of the 2023 season really firming up my opinion that the sport had transitioned into a game where there are three roles as midfielders. There's defensive midfielders, offensive midfielders, and two-way midfielders in a way that didn't previously exist. And so essentially the way I get more specific with that is there are probably two offensive midfielders on each line. Their jobs are primarily to draw slides and hammer step downs. There's a two-way midfielder whose job is to catch the ball when it's thrown to him and move it to the open guy, and once in a while dodge off the catch, maybe, you know, beat a closeout and finish when he's open. But he's going to be running to the hole, and he's going to hold up defensively if, for whatever reason, a substitution breakdown occurs and you can't get your two shorties on the field. And then obviously you've got two defensive midfielders. You know, maybe one of them you want to be able to be your guy in transition in a way that kind of makes him feel a little bit more like a two-way guy. How do you regard that breakdown of the midfield position right now? And if you agree, at least in principle with some of the elements, how does that affect how you evaluate on a role-dependent basis?
It's so funny that you asked the question. We as a staff just did our first, you know, template depth chart, and that's exactly how we categorized them. And we call them honchos, are guys that do everything for us. And essentially they're the golden honcho, and we're actually making uniforms. Our guys that are honchos have gold uniforms, because if you think about what you ask of them, they have to know how to ride, to clear, to play offense, to play defense, potentially on the wings. I mean, you ask so much more. Like, those guys don't have to carry buckets out to the field because they're asked so much. They have to be in both film sessions. I mean, the amount of meat that's on their plate is extensive. So that is the hardest thing to recruit there. I don't know if there's like a perfect answer, because traditionally they're specializing in one or the other. Then we have hybrids, and those are guys that come out of the O-door. And those are, to your point, guys that can hammer the ball. They might not be as dynamic or shifty or able to cover, but they can shoot. Or they are trigger starters, but they can't cover defensively. So hybrids are often your high school attackman that's probably not going to play attack at this level. And then we have stoppers. And to me, that's where we have to do a better job as a staff of making sure that we identify those, because it has been a strength of ours as a program. But guys that are willing to play defense and are trained to do that, and that is a mentality. And you know, there's some guys in this upcoming class that I think are getting notoriety now for doing just that. And I think that that's such an integral piece of how we want to play defense, is not having to slide to our short six every single time they're dodged on, because we know that's traditionally the guy that's going to have to bear the most burden on the field, the Tarasenkos and the Will Hawes of the world. And why has Team USA won the last two world games? In my opinion, it's the short stick D-middies. It's the Danny Logans. It's Goodrich. It's Will Hawes. It's Ryan Tarasenko. It's Bernhard. It's Kevin, you know, Kevin Unterseen. Those are the guys that I think are, allow your defense to operate the way that maybe we think is most efficient.
And then at the defensive end of the field, I guess this is a question where it's kind of it's a similar question about evolution, but it's really also about maybe how consistent or how different the role definition is and how you value skills. I guess I would frame it this way. I don't think that the skill distribution has changed by virtue of the shot clock. You still want your LSM to be rangy, turn hips and run, pick up loose balls off the wings of faceoffs, catch outlet passes, lead the transition, and make good decisions. You want to have a number one stopper who you're going to put on your opponent's best attackman. You know, obviously, who your opponent's best attackman is going to dictate a lot of times whether or not you have that matchup, right? That sometimes there's big little, there's, you know, big and fast, big and strong, you know, small and quick, ready lefty, like all those things can come into play. And that's essentially where you kind of want your second guy to be a 1A stopper. And if they can have variety in their athletic profile, all the better, because then you can be a little bit more matchup flexible and not have to change things. And then with your third guy, you know, tend to want an inside guy who doesn't get beat off ball and make sure that the other five guys know specifically, you know, who's hot, when to go, all the things that go along with that. That being said, my opinion, and this is something I really focused on during the 22 season and in the summer of 22, and I actually spent a fair amount of time watching players on the sideline with Chris Brzezinski, who we'll talk about here in a little bit, basically questioning how much should we value this skill. It feels to me like in a shot clock game, there are more ground balls where the first time ground ball scooper immediately has the ball dislodged and it goes back to the other team. And because that resets the shot clock in a lot of instances, it is even more destructive than it might have been in a pre-shot clock situation, when I also think those scenarios didn't happen as frequently. And I think there are a couple of reasons why. So the first is, I think the shot clock begets bad shots. I think bad shots are more likely to be saved, but also probably at least moderately more likely to give up rebounds. And then those rebounds end up in spaces where the defenseman who comes up with the ball is really well, really highly likely to have it checked away and then go back to the offense. So this is a long way of asking, has the ability to pick up first-time ground balls and come away from scrums, is that something you care more about now than you did 5 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, second chance opportunities are the thing that we stat now. We actually did an analytic 2 years ago, so 2022 season, and there's a 35% and on our games, there's a 35% increase in likelihood that you get scored on a second chance opportunity. And that includes foul clears, missed ground balls, shot rebound saves, essentially shot clock resets. 35%. So it's almost double. It's like 32%, and then it goes up to like 67% likelihood that you give a goal. And it has to do with fatigue, but I also think it's just emotion, right? Like I equate it to like football. You punt, they muff the punt, and then they get the ball at like the 14-yard line. Like that is such a emotionally destructive thing to do on the defensive side of the ball. And Coach P,
it's also so emotionally constructive offensively, right? It's a duplicative effect. Now you push both to farther ends of the emotional spectrum.
Yeah. And to your point on the offensive end, more of our goals are scored in a scrum. We call them scramble sessions. So anything that's not organized 6-on-6, then they are scored on 6-on-6. You know, we showed clips to our guys the other day. It's like, you guys, we want to talk about 6-on-6. You want to get to the X's and O's. But the truth is, more than 50% of our goals against Duke last year were scramble goals. Yeah, sure. We big littled, we inverted, but majority of our goals were in transition and express. So why are we spending so much time talking about 6-on-6 when really the emphasis should be, hey, pick it up and move it off the turf, because this is when the defense is the most disorganized and this is when we're going to have the greatest advantage.
Goalies. How do you evaluate goalies? It's the most important question.
It's funny. I'm probably the worst. That's the worst position I evaluate. And I think part of it is you're stubborn, right? You want what you thought was valuable. I think part of it is I also give the crutch. I'm like, well, this is one shot, one game. Shots aren't created equal. Like, I know the frustration that happens. But I have found that the voice, it does mean more than I thought in the past. Like, your confidence and command volume exudes confidence. And I believe that's true in all of sports, but specifically in that position, especially when things aren't going well. And when you see things go south, it gets really quiet. And then that pertains to your defense as well. And I'm a guy that doesn't believe, I believe in the 60-minute goaltender. Like, if you make 15 saves and you give up 15 goals, call that a minute's worth of action. So what are you doing for the other 59 minutes? How impactful are you in the clearing game? Are you a seventh defender when the ball is away from the cage or not in a shooter stick? And then how do you lead with your voice? And those are differentiators. You know, like we did a study a couple years ago, like there's like a 6-save difference between the number one goalie and the last goalie, like in terms of save percentage, right? It's so dramatic how the save changes. But yeah, we look at a first team All-American at 60%. And a guy that we wouldn't even consider at 40%, yeah, it might only be 6 saves. So how can we create like a greater gap? How you lead, how you clear, can you pick off passes? Like, I wasn't the best ball snapper, we all know that, but I was able to make an impact in so many different ways because I knew that would equate an end of a possession if I picked off a pass, just as if I had to make a save.
Yeah. Let's quickly run through how you talk to prospects and what you like to hear and what resonates. And then, like I said, there are a handful of topics that I wanted to dive a little deeper on. So how do you and your staff regard September 1st? Is it important to you? Do you have a particular strategy for how you want to go about communicating?
I think it's important that we have aspirations to compete with top 20 teams, but it's also, there's a reality in that, you know, if we have 5 commitments going into November, that would be heroic in a lot of ways, because we are shooting for the moon, right? I don't want to limit our coaching staff's ability to have high aspirations, knowing that there's going to be a lot of no's that are involved with that. So I think we have to put ourselves at the table if we're serious about some of the goals that we talk about as a program. And if we don't, if we just say, well, we're not going to get that guy, then we're already conceding to something that we ask our guys not to concede to. So, we'll get a lot of no's, but I do think we're thorough. I think we had 500 and some odd names after the summer, and then we brought that down to 141, and then we'll melt that down to 70 or 80 in the next week. And it's through research, it's through conversations, but it's also through willingness to be said no to over the next 7 days.
What can you hear that gets you excited? And it doesn't matter whether it's from, one of those 70 or 80 that are on the initial list, or, somebody you're talking to 10 months from now who's a 25 that's still on the board and now is interested in Jacksonville. What can a prospect say that really lights you up?
I mean, a connection to the place, and I know that that's so easy to say, but it's because we're so uniquely located geographically. If a parent has moved here, a family member has moved here, there is a gravitational pull when you know the area, because so many people just don't. So that to me perks my eyes up, because I know, okay, there's teeth in this, even if it might be a long shot. The second one to that would be any sort of recognition of where we think our trajectory is, because kids that we want have to be able to see what we think we're building. So if there is a mention of a successful season in the past, or a mention of, we got an email just about an hour ago from a social media video we put out, and it's a kid that's on our board. And to me, it's like, okay, we've been able to have a brand voice through social media or through a successful season in the past that's at least put, I spoke to a club coach the other day, said, I've never heard Jacksonville as many times as I've heard this year from our guys. And that might, we're not going to make their top five. I get that. But if the 1A player is talking at that club about our program, then the 1B player is hearing it. And that's just something that hasn't existed in the past for us. And there's brand recognition that we need to be really intentional with.
And then the opposite question, is there something that you can hear from a prospect that just is immediate, it kind of immediately shuts you down?
Yeah, that list is probably a little bit longer. Especially from club coaches, right? Oh, you're probably a good fit. Like, if we wanted a good fit for us where we're currently are, then we're never going to move forward, right? And I think the academic reputation, the perception is probably the most frustrating, because we have really good students, but there's a perception, right? And I get it. Everybody wants to go to the Ivies. That's the most common answer we get, and I have great respect for that. But to diminish what we do academically without having any sort of deep dive is probably the one that turns me the most. And there's certainly some other things, but that list is probably a little bit longer of immediate turnoffs.
You mentioned location a minute ago, and I want to dive. That was one of the topics I wanted to dive a little bit deeper on. It's an asset and a detriment, right? A cost and a benefit. What? How much of each? Right? It's far away, but it's on the beach. It kind of cuts both ways, right?
Yeah, the greatest challenge is thinking back to when I was at Providence and how many people would just stop in because it's off I-95. And now, one of the first things we do is look at how many direct flights there are to Baltimore, to DC, to Philly, to New York. I mean, that is top of mind. I read an article about when Jimbo Fisher took the Texas A&M job, how important it was that there was a direct flight to Atlanta, because that was such a big piece of their recruitment. And for us, those are things that we have to think about. And having a direct flight to Denver has positively impacted our program over the past 3 years. So we have to be able to kind of sell that. Thank God for Breeze Airways, increasing the amount of direct flights we have. But it's a challenge. I say it to our staff all the time. Our brand voice has to be so strong, because our greatest gate to path to entry is getting a young man here, getting a family here, especially early on in September when there's just a limited window of time to get guys down.
So one of the elements of the program that you and I have spoken about a fair amount of time is a fair amount of times, and certainly predating the pandemic and everything that happened with respect to the additional year and the prevalence of the transfer portal, was the role of transfers in building your roster and building your program. How does that impact your approach to recruiting? How does it impact the communication that you have with prospects? And what do you think it's going to mean for the Dolphins going forward?
Well, Tara, you and I have talked about this before, and the most heated I get is when we get challenged about the transfer portal for a number of reasons. Most specifically because we had the least amount of transfers. If you were to compare us in the ACC last year, we had the least amount. But at the same time, we also are, we are not gonna on. We're going to evolve with the times. And for me, I don't like calling it transfers. It is recruiting. I mean, the transfer portal is another layer of recruiting, and everybody is doing it regardless of what they say because it is the most beneficial. I quit. I'm a diehard Buffalo Bills fan. If the Buffalo Bills never get Von Miller in free agency, they're never going to be a Super Bowl team. My job is to make the most competitive lacrosse team of good people. And just transfers in the past, there was a reason why, right? They were a bad egg. It was academics. They got in trouble. That's not the case. And I can't point to a more exhibitive group of that than our current transfers. Division two middie of the year, Division three LSM of the year, guys that have an extra year of eligibility or two and want to prove that they should have played at this level 4 years ago. So I'm just so I'm so such a proponent of the ability for these guys to have a chance to come and prove themselves. And we're going to use it as a complement to what we do with our current freshmen. And people will point to, well, that was the biggest change. Why? Last year, 9 of our 10 starters were original guys, right? 4 year guys at JU. So I just have to remind guys of that. But the transfer thing is here. It's here to stay. And it allows us to be competitive, and we talk about it openly with our team. The guys know it. It's also it's part of filling your rosters. I listened to Coach Torpy the other day. Like, if you have 25 guys graduate, and we're only brought in 12 freshmen. We have less guys on our roster this year than we did last year, but we brought in more transfers. Sometimes it's your program, and people aren't willing to take the time to look deep, pull the curtains back, and say, oh, they lost some really impactful players. So it's our job to make sure that we have a few more darts on the board to make sure that we put together a competitive roster.
Just one more on that, because one of the things that I remember we spoke about a couple years ago is how different it is to recruit somebody that's already been to college and what they value and what they care about and how what your program offers might fit that better. Or at least they might value it more highly than they did 4 years earlier. Where does that fit into that? And how does that coalesce with the idea that you posed at the beginning of the conversation, which was a club director saying, I've never had as many conversations about Jacksonville as I have this year. It kind of feels like those two things, I don't want to say they go hand in hand. I think that they kind of like, they almost like replace, it almost replaces it, right? It's almost like, all right, well, if we're getting a little bit more traction with 16-year-olds, then maybe the fact that, we were getting more traction with 20-year-olds isn't as pertinent.
Yeah, it's certainly twofold. They play hand in hand. How what our impact is on the recruiting trail, and I told our staff the other day, success leaves clues, right? In 2022, we had a successful season. Well, that doesn't show up again until the 2024 recruiting class. And I shared that with our 2023 families this fall when they arrived on campus was, hey, you guys were the last group that came to us on blind trust. You came to us with a 500 record and no facility and limited proof that we could get over the hump. Whereas the 2024s, it was a little bit easier for them because they saw what we were capable of doing. And hopefully the 2025s are a product of last year's season. So it's funny how it kind of has its year to year cycle. With the transfers, the beauty is you're talking to an adult. That you're talking to a young man that isn't looking at Googling a university and looking at a ranking. They've been to class. They understand what's important. They understand what housing looks like. They understand what's meaningful to them academically. And that's where we get students from Georgetown, students from Johns Hopkins and North Carolina and Lynchburg and Tufts. I mean, those are really well-versed young men that know what's important to them once they get here.
When you think about this continued evolution, one of the elements of it is staff, right? Like you can only do so much. So, I mentioned Coach Przinski, who runs the defense and is heavily involved in recruiting. But in addition to that, you've also had a staff change in the last 2 years. So, how do you kind of balance that? The continuity versus the familiarity, or I'm sorry, the continuity versus the new energy, and making sure that everybody kind of gets up to speed and is communicating the same way. So, who's on your staff, and what are their roles, and how have you kind of balanced that continuity versus infusion of energy that I just laid out?
Yeah, I appreciate asking that because of all the recruiting I did this summer, the best thing I did was our staff. Obviously, being able to retain Chris and promote him to the associate head coach role, which was a no-brainer and has been already the impact is felt with our team. But to be able to hire Shane Coppins as our offensive coordinator, and again, a lot like we do in recruiting, it's like, there's a bunch of names, there's a bunch of sexy names out there, PLL guys, et cetera. We did our homework. I think we interviewed 12 different people, and Shane's attitude, his positivity, his optimism is what we needed. We needed a guy that wanted to dream a little bit bigger, each year. And I think that Shane has proven to be that. And then JT Giles-Harris, I mean, we've been recruiting him for a couple of years. It feels like kind of behind the scenes. We played Hampton a few years ago and we were up by a good amount of goals, and he coached in such an admirable way, regardless of the scoreboard. And it's something that you talk about in an interview, but to see it in live action, I mean, that guy is a rising star. And I'm talking about things away from the lacrosse field. And the greatest thing that we have that nobody talks about is our director of operations, who's been at Jacksonville now for a decade. Danielle Della Rocca is, I mean, she is the reason why we've been able to tell a story. She's the reason why our guys have a Power Five experience, even if we're not a Power Five school. I mean, she goes above and beyond to make sure that our guys are treated in a way that they feel like they can beat Duke. And I don't think we do it without her servant leadership and make and her commitment to make sure that our guys feel like they belong at that level. So we are about as well rounded as it gets right now. And again, I credit Coach P and Danielle for being with me on that search committee. It wasn't just me; they were on every interview, they were at every dinner. We felt like we wanted to make this hire to ascend our program, and we had a really good thing going with our staff, and we wanted to try to see if we could, elevate ourselves, and I think we did that this summer.
So how do each, Coach Pruszynski, Coach Coppins, and Coach Giles-Harris, how do their roles distribute when it comes to recruiting, both from an evaluation and a communication standpoint?
Yeah, again, our net's so big that we can't say, well, you're going to recruit the offense, you're the defense, you're this club team, you're the state. Like for us, it's got to be all hands on deck, and it's more enjoyable that way because something in the past that we've done is we've tried to just cover as much as we could. Let's just cover as much ground, and then we get into the office in August, and it's like, well, Chris saw these guys, I saw these guys, and Shane and JT saw these guys. But none of us had cross-pollination. So one of our new rules is you got to have two sets of eyes. I feel like we've made some mistakes because of that. And the two sets of eyes rules has been so enjoyable because it's two people pounding on the table. And then there's so much more confirmation when you make a decision. So it's been really fun. We're going to have a meeting after this call, which is like our 13th meeting of our staring at our board. But the conversation has legs because there's more than just one person that's, trying to push their guy. So while we might not cover as much ground, having Chris and I sit on the same field at NAL together, it was like we were making decisions on the spot versus coming to the office and trying to make an argument, which has been really fun. So all four of us are all hands on deck. And again, we're gonna shoot the moon, right? We're gonna be laughed at a few times with phone calls, but that's okay, right? We got to be willing to be said no to. And I think we also have some groundwork because of our I think of our genuine evaluations this summer.
So, I realizing that we're recording before September 1st and this will post afterward, trying to get a little bit more of a sense for the class of 2025. Generally speaking about it, where do you think it falls in terms of overall quality relative to prior years? Where does it, are there any outliers in terms of, particularly strong or particularly weak at this position group versus this position group? From an academic profile standpoint, from a region of the country standpoint, are there any things about this group that are unique relative to prior years?
It's funny. I actually, I think you guys posted something the other day, some quotes about from certain coaches, and I laugh because there's so many good players, and I it's always like, and I'm in a group chat with, Coach Orson and Unnerstein and Donatsky, and it's like, oh, this, these guys aren't that good. Or I was like, what are you talking about? There's a ton of good players. I get to the level of Twart and finalists. Who knows, right? You even heard Coach Whitley on your pod, talk about Kirst and like there's an evaluation. He's not that. Well, there's a ton of good players. There's a ton of All-Americans that are coming in. I do think that the defense I have found has been a struggle in the past of like, hey, who are these stoppers? Who are guys with elite feet and not cute sticks? I mean, I do think that defense is deeper than it has been. I think there's a depth of short stick D middies, guys that play short stick D middie at the position versus, you know, Dave Lawson being trained to play D middie to then turn into an O middie. Like, I do think there's some guys that take pride in that position. I always think the goalie and faceoff thing, I think it's always top heavy. I think there's always elite, but I also, you know, I flip it on its head and say, well, if you look at the PLL, it's like St. Bonaventure, Manhattan, like these goalies are Albany. They're coming from places that aren't the top 10 schools. So I always think the goalie position kind of evolves throughout college as well. So I'm hesitant to say there's a weak. I do think Philly has a ton of good players. I think those schools have continued to produce some really high level players in the Maryland area, of course. But you know, we try to be so geographically diverse, and I feel like I do have a good grasp on, hey, these are the four or five Texas players that have really blossomed, and these are the six or seven, you know, Ohio guys through Resolute or et cetera that have really, you know, taken hold of a top 50 type recruit window. So I'm always hesitant to answer that question. I always talk to recruit guys. I love talking to Ty on the road and just, you know, get his opinion because you're looking at like the top 20, and yeah, I see like this really cool value at 80 through 100 that we're excited about. So I laugh at those guys when they say that it's a weak class, and I see all these guys that we'd love to have.
Right, no doubt. One of the things that is going to be unique about this, not necessarily relative to last year, but relative to years prior to that, is the role that name, image, likeness opportunities present. How does Jacksonville regard that as a program, and how do you feel like it's going to manifest in terms of the decisions that prospects make this fall?
Yeah, you know, we have started to explore. You know, we do have a collective. Our you know, our university and friends of the program have a collective, and it is something that I think is unique for our level of institution and how we can be impactful for certain recruits. How that impacts the incoming class, I don't know. I don't think it does for groups like us. I do think there's obviously a greater window for those Power Five schools. I think for us to take a chance on that with an underclassman is a risky deal. I think our athletic director is really proactive and thinking about the legality of that and the you know, the impact it could have if you don't come through, you know. And I think that's something that's happened is, you know, it's such like kind of a handshake agreement, and there's some bending of how that rule is interpreted that, you know, RAD is on the NCAA council, and you know, it's interpreted a lot of different ways, and how schools deal with it is very you know, flexible to say the least. So I think the greater impact that could have is certainly for us in the portal and the ability to financially support a kid if that's something that could happen down the road. But we don't dive too much into it early on because, as we mentioned, a lot of these guys, I mean, even if we were to, they're still gonna pursue the Ivies or pursue the ACCs, and we understand that, and I don't blame them. But we want to make sure when we do it, it's meaningful and it's somebody that could impact us right away.
Right, makes sense. John Galloway, I think we covered a lot of ground. It's so easy to have these conversations with you because you talk so fast and concisely. It's like your points just roll off. It's incredible. So I allotted 35 minutes. This is the first one we're coming in 2 minutes under. You're economical and efficient with your time. You should take it as a compliment.
I appreciate it. Well, you know, I have less than 12 hours till 9:01, so I'm keeping my schedule tight here going into it. But I appreciate you having me. I listen to them all, and thankful that you were willing to have us on.
Of course, absolutely, John. Anytime. Look forward to getting eyes on the Dolphins, hopefully this fall, if not certainly next spring. And good luck as you continue to build your class of 2025 and finish out your 24s.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.